welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined again by Benita Roy, who is the founder of the Pop-Up School, Aldalore Insight Center, C-Labs, and is an associate of Perspectiva. For me, Benita, somebody at the forefront of thinking about our current approaches to consciousness, perception, and metaphysics. And today we're going to talk about shifting into what she calls the lyric culture and our focus on crisis, the mentality of crisis and wholeness and the self. Let's dive in.
Hi, Benita. It's good to be with you again. How are you doing, first of all?
Good. Happy New Year 2024.
Another year. We'll see what this year brings us. But yeah, you're okay?
I'm great.
I, as ever, really enjoy being connected to you via your output, via email, which is just so rich. I don't get the chance to attend the live sessions as I would love to, but you're very prolific. And there's a few things you shared that I'd love to explore today in our conversation. So I thought about just reading actually something you wrote and then just seeing how you riff on that. So
yeah. Let's just tell people it's the Substack, my Substack called the Pop-Up School. So
highly recommended. Yeah. Buddy, highly recommended. You wrote, I believe 2024 will be an inflection point, bringing us an entirely new view on what is possible. A new spirit is being born. It is our responsibility to both enact and reflect, to sing and to dance, to recognize and amplify this new spirit. It is the spirit of voyaging to the future and coming back to tell others about the worlds we have seen. To demonstrate with confidence and vigorous joy that the future is calling us to these new worlds. Yes, along the way, there will be destruction and terror, unimaginable horrors and intense grieving for what will be lost, for massive cultural and planetary extinction events. But in this chaos, a new spirit is waiting to be born. The new spirit is a set of twins, yin and yang, Eros and Thumos. But this time they will not be made two as they vow to voyage together. Which I really, really appreciate reading that. And I'm just wondering if you could, speak further into that in whichever way you feel moved.
Yeah, now that I've listened to you, I'm remembering where that spirit came from. I had planned to revise the Pop-Up School look and wasn't quite sure where it was going to go. And I had this intuition, maybe what I was going to do with it. And that was one day I was just, clicking around YouTube. And I happened to click on the little video excerpt from Blade Runner, the Tears of Rain excerpt.
That's so stunning.
And usually when you watch that, it's in the context of the movie, it's very sad. It's beautiful, but it's sad. And then I was realizing what he was saying is he had seen things that people, couldn't even imagine. And it just struck me about how fortunate he was, this cyborg, to have been able to see these things. And I realized that all of a sudden, how I was experiencing reality was like that. Like every day, humans, you can imagine going to Mars where, maybe it's impoverished and humans trying to say what they've seen would be unimaginable. And, in that little clip, he's also talking about wars that he saw and, you can imagine the death and destruction that he saw, but his whole, and of course he's holding that dove. And, so I have to admit that that was when this posture, or this feeling tone of what the new spirit was, that's where it came from. This kind of reversal of meaning. I've seen that clip before and it's always really sad and something else was really coming through. And And it made me realize I'd been, you know, kind of talking about warning people not to get into the mentality of crisis for a while, but it really landed that there's, you know, in times of accelerated change and unpredictability and volatility, all these words we use, this type of orientation or view can open up. We can shift to that. And so I talked about how myself, among others, we use this word, a time in between worlds. And I think that was very potent. I first heard Zach Stein in his book, Education in Time Between Worlds. And it was a very powerful way, a very powerful trope to think of our time. But I, with this new appreciation, I felt that that was no longer reflected my experience. We live in this world. We have the extraordinary privilege of witnessing this world. And this notion of time between worlds is kind of like, well, we're like just waiting for the new world to be born. And it seemed quite impotent relative to this new spirit, this new feeling that was percolating in me and kind of became more concrete when I saw that clip.
I'd love to dive in a little bit more to this idea of the new spirit, but you said like I've been warning about a mentality of crisis for a while. Could you just say a bit more about that too?
Yeah. So in my chapter in the Metamodern book called Time, Change, and Causality, the ending is on metamorphosis and talking about how it's how as humans we're not really good with change. And I talk about how when we think of change, even if we kind of talk about resilience or working with complexity and change, we actually adopt this kind of false narrative that I use the metaphor of the butterfly, and it's the butterfly knows he's going to be, you know, the caterpillar knows he's going to be a butterfly. As a caterpillar, he just wants to eat more and get bigger. And then he imagines, you know, on the other side, he's just going to like fly more and lay more eggs, you know. But he never reconciles with the fact that in between phase, neither of those things happen. It's chaotic and mushy and messy and gooey, and your cells get rearranged. And this is, I think, how, we end up when we think of this in-between phase, what it's required to be surprised, to be, face unanticipated experiences. We settle into this notion of crisis because we want all change to just be like, okay, I can change, you know, I can change, but we have this kind of fallacy where we're like, okay, on the other side, I'm just going to get bigger and fly faster also, you know, that everything is just going to be in the same direction. The good is always in that direction. And so when we do taste, what is required, in these, what I've been calling back loop realities, right? So, Donna Haraway talked about, it comes from the panarchy cycle where, after exploitation and the conservation and, you know, apex predators and all your resources are connected into larger and larger systems, the system becomes more fragile and eventually it breaks apart and you have this back loop, in the, illustration. And, so it's not useful to be in a crisis mode if you're in a back loop reality, because by definition, things are unpredictable. You can't make sense. Things are going to be surprising. So if you're in a mode of crisis, you're trying to make things more predictable and you're trying to make things less surprising and you're trying to be resilient. And this is not possible, in these extraordinary times. So it requires a shift in, appreciating, that we live in, you know, interesting times, as they say.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. That's why I always liked speaking to you, because it's an invitation into making conscious a lot of the ontological ways that I might be holding that I've inherited from these, you know, from the times I've been in that kind of just under the surface are like habitual ways I just respond to crisis or uncertainty. So. And I think part of the relief I feel is in, as well as recognizing that, you know, there's like going to be, destruction and grief and loss, that actually that crisis mentality, the mentality of crisis that you described is also, you know, is also part of that ontologically habituated response. And, you know, that kind of comes with a liberating feel with it, as well as this invitation you're making, or this kind of evocation of a new spirit being born. So yeah, I just wanted to name that, and you could riff on that, but also just maybe speak a bit more about, therefore, this invitation, you know, like this inflection point, like, what is this new spirit, you know, in a sense? How can we orient towards it? If these are even the right questions, you know, because maybe even the questions come out of a, you know, that same impulse.
Yeah. So there's so much to say here. One of the things about this notion of new spirit, and tie it into some practical. And that is, if you want to have like start over, you know, you have a business, you want to start a business, you want to start over, or if you had a relationship that's you've broken up and you want a new relationship, this notion of starting over. One of the mistakes people make is their past experience will overdetermine how they start over. Right. So you either look for the same thing or you look for the opposite of it. You know, like, we don't want to build a department like that. Those people are too slow. Now you build a department that, you know, you're designing for speed, but it's still stuck in the past because it's still a response to the past. Right. So one of the notions of not being in a crisis mentality is being able to uncouple or decouple from your priors, and to try to see like a child, what is the case as if you've never seen it before, right? Start to work with more fundamental, capacities like listening and observing and, rebuild, your imaginarium. You know, we live in an imaginary world. We think we know how politics works and how finance works, and it's all abstraction. So can I rebuild my imaginarium from concrete experiences that I'm having now, instead of importing, you know, the whole list of priors, whether I'm including that which I want to preserve and not let go of, and that which I want to get rid of. Can I make a clean sweep? Can I erase the ledger? You know, this is another thing people do that we talk a lot about in my workshops, is modern society has produced a certain type of subjectivity in us where we keep ledgers. Right. So, you know, this happens with young couples all the time. I've coached a lot of people. I'm like, ah, the ledger, you know? So you think you have this mutual dependency and you're being friends to each other. But in reality, I did this and I did that. You actually have this little thing in the back of your head that's a ledger that's counting, like who keeping a balance sheet, right? And this happens, like, it's so pernicious that people, you can really laugh because you think you're not doing that. You may have worked really hard in your life at work and this and that, and you don't really realize it. But a lot of the source of our irritation and our anxiety and our anger and our unhappiness and we evaluate the quality of our life based on these ledgers. And the ledger, we don't want to import the ledger. We don't want to import the balance sheet on that ledger. We would try to start not using a ledger anymore. The ledger is really, it's really a pernicious tool.
And just, I know you're going to probably say more, but I get the example of the ledger in relationships, you know, where, I'm kind of, taking stock of what my partner or other people have been doing and tallying it up, and it's all feeding into a certain narrative or assessment. And but are you saying that's just going ubiquitous everywhere? So maybe I'm doing that with the economy or the politics or environmental destruction.
And yourself.
And myself.
I disappointed myself today, and maybe you've got a couple of ticks down, or today I'm happy, a couple of ticks up. And there's it's kind of like eating something that doesn't taste well, and it's an aftertaste. Every experience has this aftertaste, a tick up or a tick down. And this is really not helpful or useful. And obviously in trade, you want to have tokens where, if I sell you my car, we want to have something that concludes the transaction. I'm not saying that, but in terms of your actual life and actual relationships, the problem is that this kind of, you could say it's transactional, but there's no real exchange. But this kind of subjectivity gets downloaded into us as modern people. And so much so, when Charles Eisenstein first started talking about the gift economy and people read that book, people started having people come over to Europe or to the US and they put them up and doing all this stuff like gifts. And then they would be mad. Like, I let them stay at my house when they came over here, but they didn't let me stay. I'm like, that's not a gift economy. That's a ledger, so that's another part of what we talked about last year at the Pop-Up School, but, this notion of having don't have the past overdetermine, and then don't start the ledger will overdetermine your next experience or your next experience. So how can we, in these times of novelty, be novel? Be in sync with novelty by becoming novel.
Could you give me an example of that in your own life? How that might have occurred, and maybe tying that also to seeing like a child and just listening and observing, how do you practice that, or how does it show up for you?
So we might have talked about this last time, but I have this philosophy I'm writing about complex potential states, also all about latent potency. And in when I lost my job in 2012 due to the recession, I was in this very strange state. I mean, I had been doing, I was head of operations at a landscape architecture design build firm. My whole reality was I was really good at systematizing, and we had 2 or 3 years of work in the pipe and resourcing. And then all of a sudden, I came back from the office and I had no income and no job, and I just had space. So we talked about this. And then years later, I end up doing a presentation at Dave Snowden's retreat in Whistler, and I'm talking about complex potential states because I'm saying, how did like X number of years later, I go from this void, this novelty, this complete collapse of any tethering to my previous reality to doing this cool thing? And it wasn't that I was responding to anything. I didn't have anything, threats to respond to. I mean, I had financial pressures, but I didn't have any money, so I couldn't do anything about it. I didn't have any, wasn't like there was a push. There was no evolutionary pressure. There was just open-endedness. And yet, something grew in that space, right? So that's the notion of coming to understand how novelty and to have you're being able to reboot or start over without starting against something or be in I call it pro tension. It's kind of a tension, you know, you feel anxiety, but it's toward something. It's not tension against. You're not being pushed or pulled. So that's one thing. And the ledger thing, I learned from my relationship with my husband over 30 years. You know, first I left my job so I could write, and then he lost his job, and then I had to get a job, and I became the wage earner. And just going back and forth, noticing how, as we changed roles, how corrosive trying to keep up with who was contributing more, either in terms of, you know, working on the farm or money. And that really made it very salient to me because we changed roles as major wage earners a couple of times. And then I started noticing how subtle it was, and I just wanted it out of me. You know, I just exercised it. I was like, I'm not going there. It took a lot of mindfulness because, you know, you had to really, I really hated it. I really hated when I could see the subtle, the subtle accounting that was going on.
I know I'm maybe taking us off in a slightly different direction, but I really appreciate this. And so we'll come back to those things you're writing down, and we'll come back to this idea of the new spirit. But I'm wondering about, I'm just reflecting on the invitation in our times, you know, for me, like even as I'm thinking about, on the one hand, you know, I've got like this kind of propensity, this, you know, this weight of like, I'm a father, I'm in a family, I've got a business. And so, you know, there's this whole kind of set of characteristics or aspects of my life. And then there's this, also this pull towards novelty, or, you know, the kind of sense of how the structure that and the certainty that I used to operate within is also breaking down, and maybe revealing that chaos or that potential that was always there that somehow was covered over. And so I'm thinking about, therefore, the impulse to create contemplative novel spaces in my own life whilst being a father, whilst owning a business, you know, because, you know, I don't like, it's not like I'm in your situation, you know, where you just suddenly lost your job and boom. But maybe we're all going to be catapulted into spaces like that more and more. And the pandemic was an example of that. But, you know, there's just like, you know, it's happening all the time now, isn't it? So just kind of contextualizing a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that more and more people are going to face this, you know, just at the end of the road, there's just a cliff. When I lost my job, it went through my whole kind of cohort, really. Many of my friends were top level managers at, you know, still young, 55 to 60, who had worked in the same place for a long time. And they too, it was like a rolling thing. I was one of the earlier ones, and then my brother-in-law. And then we thought this brother-in-law was safe, but year later, you know, just rolled through. And so you had people at the top really of some of their capacities in business. And this was across all different industries of my friends, who, were in the same, you know, predicament. Some of them had extreme, psychological problems for a while. So I'm saying one of the things, one of the experiments at, you know, the pop-up school, we do a lot of experiments in living, and the question is, can we, given that we've had the good fortune of having these cataclysmic, upheavals in our own lives, can we learn from them and, be kind of a basis or a grounding of sanity inside society, inside culture, when more and more of this is going to happen to a lot more people? I mean, I've had to go through this many times in the course I used to teach. That school also was sold. That program was sold due to COVID. But when people, young people, you know, having basically meltdowns over Trump and then Kavanaugh and their partners becoming entangled in the dark web and in conspiracy theories, and then COVID when people didn't know what was real and what was, you know, and people start like going crazy, and we would just try to get a handle on it. You know, the mind, the human mind has not always been rational, and magical thinking has been the way we've done most of our evolutionary heavy lifting through these kinds of ways the human mind metamorphs under different types of situations, you know? So this is also another look of view at what we can expect. So for example, in November, I had people staying here and a whole group coming at the end of November, and they were coming for a horse workshop. And the day they were supposed to arrive, half the group, their plane got rerouted and were coming the next day. So between the two days that they arrived, my favorite horse died suddenly. It's very cute, colitis. At 2 o'clock, she was perfectly fine. By 11 o'clock, she was dead. And it was just, you know, like I felt like I was losing my mind. And, I never knew anything like that. The vet understood it. And so what happened was I started getting into magical thinking. Is there rat poison in the hay? Is there this? Is there that? You know, what's this? What's that? Then I started thinking, what's the message? You know, you notice yourself, entering into different kinds of consciousness. Now, this is kind of helpful because if it was one of those things, you know, by process of elimination, you would, be alerted to some potential, you know, problems. But, so another thing about what we're talking about in terms of these cataclysmic events that might happen to people is also to understand the way it will affect us, and not to even be in a crisis mode about the fact that you're in magical thinking. When I lost my job, you know, I couldn't even come into this room, which is a great office. I didn't come into this room for like 8 or 9 years because it's where I had, we ran our business, and I had to pay the bills. And I spent all my time in the studio next door. That's how, again, like you just, these ways in which we, a rational kind of systematic or systematized life, when it changes like the structures of who we are. So to look at that with open eyes too, and not to grasp at trying to be the rational person that I was 10 minutes ago, or, you know, allow all of this to be in play as novelty, I think is part of what we're trying to talk about, the new spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. And, this brings up the, I was going to ask then about the new spirit and lyric culture. And also, you were running live retreats on cultivating the natural state.
Mm-hmm.
And, so yeah, actually, maybe that's a good question to just ask you to speak about the connection between those and this new spirit. And, yeah, you know, I get the sense that you're talking about this shift out of the abstracted rational mind or beyond it in some way, you know. Could you say more about what the natural state is and lyric culture?
Yeah. So I'll double back to, you know, the excerpt that you read. It ends with this idea of these yin and yang twins. You know, they recognize that they're twins. And this is a big part of also what we don't want to import into like lyric culture, which is our word for some new kind of culture. One of the things that we are habituated to as humans is what I call splits, right? So it's similar to the ledger, except it's not a balance sheet of your experience. It's a measurement of, you're evaluating people by categories, for example. So a split is, oh, men are like this, women are like that. And you put some properties, good properties in the female category, and you put some bad properties of men in the male category, and you make a split, right? We unfortunately have been becoming more and more like this, categorizing things not across a spectrum of richness, but in terms of splits. Now, you have to be careful because the mind, these splits are very pernicious. So someone might say, oh, well, now we don't just have men and women, we have queer and we have transgender and stuff. But those are just more splits. Instead of just having two splits, you have like all these categories, right? So some of the splits are not binary. They've gotten to be quite thin, and you know, many of them, but they're still splits because you're subtly putting experience, you're categorizing people more like in the category they are and making meaning out of that. So when we do the exercise, I used to do it in my master's class all the time, you would have this like these columns, and you would put, especially in our postmodern tolerant world, you would put something like a Muslim girl, and you'd have a plus column and you'd have a minus column, and people would check plus. I like Muslim girls. And then you would say rich white man, and they would be like, oh, maybe I like the fact that I'm tolerant of Muslim women, but then you notice you have a big minus for rich white man, you know? And so the categories switch between generations or different, you know, different communities. But the point is that you have these grids that you're working with. You're operating with grids, and they prejudge your experience, right? That's what prejudice is. So one of the things about, if you want to talk about lyric culture, or if you want to talk about your natural state doesn't have splits. So you basically, in cultivating or recognizing the natural state, you're trying to notice how much of what your operating system is just conceptual elaborations. So a split is just a conceptual elaboration. And you may swear that men are from, you know, Mars and women are for Venus, but this is just an ingrained split. Doesn't mean that people aren't different. That's not the point. So that's one thing that, in terms of recognizing your natural state, you recognize these ledgers, you recognize the splits, you recognize, and the difficult thing about recognizing these things is it's easy to recognize and you can be happy that, you no longer are prejudiced against Muslim girls, right? So, but it's hard to recognize the ones that you actually, you know, the splits that you're actually entrenched in. It's easy to, try to work on it's, and it's, easier for people to try to work on not, using a ledger against people, but it's harder to not use a ledger to give them positive points either. So a lot of, if you're a decent human being, a lot of the real hard work is in to decouple from these habits that are ordinarily considered as social goods, because they're just actually the good part of they're twins too, right? Is it to always privilege women or the feminine is a twin to putting a bad mark on the masculine. So they're just twins of social good. So that's those kinds of things are part of recognizing the natural state. And another aspect of it, because I wrote it down, I'll just put this into it, is understanding complexity, you might say, understanding living systems, truly understanding. I mean, everybody knows that life is complex, that organic reality is complex. Nature is beautifully complex. And, we kind of get mixed up because, we'll call things that are very, very, very complicated, complex. But one of the things we'll talk about in recognizing the natural state, and I talk about in my my group that's working on complex potential states, is that there are certain principles of complexity that you can count on. And one of the principles is if you're doing complexity right, you will get energy for free. If you're adding more effort and adding more effort, you're doing complexity wrong. If you're gardening, well, there's this great video online, 100,000 Beating Hearts, and he used to be a conventional rancher, and then he started going no antibiotics, and then finally over the years he got completely sustainable, and it's just energy for free. The chickens eat the nematodes that poison that infect the sheep, and the sheep eat the nematodes, the worms and they just rotate, and he doesn't have anything to do anymore, and the eagles come back, and the whole ecosystem becomes self-sustaining. And so one of the things, if you're someone listening to this podcast and you're interested in complexity, I guarantee you don't understand complexity if you're not liberating energy for free in the system. So that's another principle. So we have these few handful of things you can really count on. And these kinds of fundamental principles, no ledger, no splits, energy for free, complex potential states, are the principles that we are trying to build lyric culture on. And the last thing I'll say about lyric culture is one way to define it is through this series. And we can see how people have glued culture together in our evolutionary past. So when we were hominids like other animals, we glued our culture, our clan together by touch, by mutual grooming, right? And there are studies that show, you know, if a certain animal, a certain monkey or something, doesn't groom X number of his clan mates X times a day, they will be isolated, right? So at first it's touch. So, then it's gesture. So at a certain level in evolution, I don't actually have to touch you. I can make a smile gesture or a warming gesture, or I can tell many people that, you know, through certain gestures that, they're safe with me, or nickering, you know, gestures. So then you go from eye touch, to, you know, gesture. And then you get to sound. And so the first sounds is I sing. The first oralities were singing, which was just a disclosure of your experience. And then the second, was I say, right? So now we're using, even animals will sing, and even animals can say, they can say there's danger up ahead or something. So now we're getting more and more, explicit. And then with the mythic culture, we get, I tell stories, and you get Homer and the epics, Gilgamesh and the Iliad and the Odyssey. So I tell. And what something that's interesting that's happening in this progression is that the singing and the saying is more participatory, whereas the telling starts to become one directional. You know, I tell you more than what I'm saying, right? So these stories that are telling you your place in history or telling you rather than just saying. So there's a progression here. Then you get the Axial Age coming out of that, and it's I name. So what Plato and Socrates did is they took these myths. So you have the myths of these Greek mythologies. You have these great stories. And the problem with the stories is you have the hero is sometimes an asshole, and the person that is a loving father, you know, turns into, shapeshifts into some animal and rapes his children. Like in these stories, there's all this stuff going on, right? And so when you get to, the Axial Age and you're naming things, you're saying, well, we can't use this story to say what courage is because sometimes he's a coward. So let's just name, let's abstract from these stories and name these virtues, right? Because in reality, you never find them in experience. You have to start naming things. And this, of course, is the Axial Age mind, which we've inherited, and we categorize and name things all the time. Then what I say is lyric culture is a move towards singing and saying without naming, but also we say in lyric culture, I disclose. I'm not telling or naming, I disclose. And what does that mean? That means I'm making something transparent in reality, in my experience of reality, directly for you to witness. Just, you know, you disclose yourself. So that's another thing we're doing with lyric culture, is trying to move from naming and justifying to disclosing. And, you know, people can go to the Substack. I think all the original, all this is in articles that are free at this point. And then the last thing for lyric culture is we have this notion of ontological design for backloop reality. So we're trying to be present with backloop realities. And then what is the ontological design? What are the buildings, the crafts, the artifacts, the testaments that are critical to design within these surprising and accidental realities that we live in. So that was a lot. There's a lot.
How let me share what I'm hearing first, and then I'll share that question. So it's like I'm hearing a journey away from the rational abstracting self, you know, that's you know, with these ledgers, counting everything, splitting, categorizing things, and is therefore somehow disconnected from this different kind of experience, which I feel like you're pointing to. And so there's this sense of coming back into the immediacy or direct participation with the, like the livingness of life in some way. I mean, these are all my words. And like a different kind of sensibility inside of that, that it's not saying in order to name, maybe there's a different kind of reason to name, and just singing as an expression rather than telling, you know, and this kind of intimacy and vulnerability you name. And so I wonder if that is, you know, something like a Taoist kind of perspective, or, you know, is this what some of the, how is this similar or different to what some of the traditions, spiritual traditions point to, you know, like in terms of a natural state? You know, where one is like in this immediate kind of co-arising or contact with life.
Yeah, there's a lot that rings true, that resonates with Taoism, and Buddhism. But one of the difficulties is that naming it the natural state is itself a difficulty, a challenge, right? So I think that we have different body minds than we were back there. Then this notion of ledger, these words are more resonant with how we are actually rationalizing things but there is some, you know, recapitulation of the past in terms of this more openness. But disclosing is difficult. It's something that we would have to practice. Intimacy is something, it's very important to lyric culture. Jan Zawicki wrote about lyric philosophy, said that lyric culture, or maybe I said this, I can't remember anymore, but we say lyric culture promotes intimacy the way theoretic culture promotes literacy, right? So years ago, I wrote the illiterate of the future will be those who cannot feel. So this is all prefiguring what we call lyrical culture. It's definitely not in the same groove of posthumanism or transhumanism. And I guess at a certain point, we need to talk about technology and AI. That I haven't written about in terms of lyric culture yet. So yeah, intimacy is important. This notion of disclosure is, I don't know if we want to talk about it, but it's,
sure. Yeah. Could you say, yeah. What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
um,
So maybe you've had this experience, like when you're a kid, it's a religious idea in many ways. So when you were a kid, you know, and you'd hang out with your father, he'd come down for breakfast and he'd come back home for work and he did this and he did that. 99% of your experience is framed in this way that he's your father. And then one day, maybe he's just in his room reading or something, or maybe fumbling with a shirt or something. And all of a sudden you see him, like who he really is disclosed to you. Like, oh my God, he's a frail man. Or, oh my God, he's sad too. Or, oh my God, like something of his real him gets disclosed to you, gets revealed to you, let's say. This happened to me. That happened to me. It happened to me once. I went to a fancy school. And my best friend, who was my roommate, his father worked for Shearson Lehman before it merged with American Express. They lived in New Canaan. They were very, very rich. My parents were not. And they came to pick me up after one Thanksgiving break. They came to pick me up because I was going to drive back to school with them. And my mother was very excited, and she opened the door. And when she saw them, I was excited too. And then I came around the corner and she had this posture. She was ashamed of herself in her house. Like, she didn't realize how different. And I was like, I mean, I wasn't, but like something, I learned something very, very interesting about my mother then. So disclosure is when you're doing that for the other person on purpose.
Mm.
Can I disclose? And so that's the personal. And so where your umbilical cord of your being touches reality, can you disclose that? So this is an interesting notion.
Yeah. Yeah. And how, I mean, you know, there's a lot of practices out there now that are, you know, like circling, these kind of, where people are practicing revealing themselves. You know, of course you could say like that's the very notion that you're doing that as an intended practice might actually create, which might close down that possibility for true disclosure. But I'm just curious if it's, how you might practice disclosure, actually. Yeah. Disclosing oneself.
Well, you can't say, tell or name it, who you are. You might be able to sing it. I have this saying that I wrote last year, and it's coming along the lines of this. And that is, I wrote, I want the words to come out of my mouth the way I want the dance to come out of my body, entirely without thought. So if you're in conversation, which like we are, we're using words, but disclosure is somehow I'm saying with my body, we're here seeing each other, that what I'm saying doesn't matter. The words, they don't matter. I'm trying to use the words in a certain way. I'm trying to use my voice in a certain way, trying to connect in a certain way. So I'm disclosing something. And I could be singing. I'm not a good singer. So in a way, the words matter, but it's the experience underneath the conversation that's disclosing something. And as people moving into these surprising times, we need to learn to look at other people like that, like not just pay attention to what they're saying, but what is their body saying? What is their gesture saying? What is their posture saying? That is, and then more reality is revealed to me, even though they're not trying to disclose it. So something like that. It's a very strange word.
I love it. This podcast, a lot of coaches are listening to this, and actually, I think this is an art for coaching, you know, that the art of being able to perceive people on this level, you know, that's not just the words, but or beyond the words to their embodied way of being in that moment. And what it might be revealed, they might be disclosing to you that they don't even know they're disclosing to you, right. But actually can be made kind of conscious in the conversation in some way or spoken to. And, how word can even, is the word, are the words aligned with that disclosure or is there a disconnection perhaps? And, And this maybe is in the realm of, but maybe we're always transmitting something, but there's a kind of particular kind of transmission or expression that can come as this disclosure is held in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and I'm hearing, in, again, this theme of like, a natural kind of expression, unmediated through when you said before about actually even just that poem, that line you shared with me about the, may my words be thoughtless. You know, I think I can't remember exactly what you said, but, and for me, that really pointed directly to this kind of almost Gnostic or natural experience of, flow, you know, again, it's hard to put words to it, but it's like every, the wholeness. And this might be a good point to bring in wholeness as a word, but it's like, can everything's that contact you were talking about? There's a kind of expression and contact, and it's more verb like than noun like. So yeah, I don't know. You can just respond, but also for you, like, attending to experience as a whole, is this like, yeah, are we in that territory as we have this conversation?
Yeah, just double back a little. Now you understand why some of the things we were talking about earlier are very important. So if you're trying to disclose, be in relationship where you're disclosing, and you're doing splits or ledgers, this is why it's not possible. It's not possible to even get into the practice if some of these habitual ways, patterns aren't already dissolved, right? So, just kind of showing how these things, relate. And yes, you're right. The interesting thing about, people is that they have fragmented selves and they are not even, they don't even disclose. You know, they have these tricks. The ego has a trick to create a narrative self so that you pretend that's who you are and you can't really touch base with, you know, something more primordial, let's say, in being you or being an organism or being a creature. The coach, I think, it is an art. And I think that the coach should always be talking to the personality, not the personality, but the self that's trying to disclose itself to its own self. So if you're a coach, you're talking to that inner self. And if you're some kind of guru, you're trying to, turn the mirror right of the inner self on to the person. You know, that's always tricky. It's like there's a movie with, a famous actor, one of the oldies, can't remember who, Rock Hudson or something, where there's this serial killer, the Peeping Tom in London, I think. And, I think Tony Curtis or somebody is the serial killer and Rock Hudson or somebody is the detective. And they finally capture him. And then there's a psychiatrist in the room and the Peeping Tom, the serial killer has, you know, a totally split personality. So the nice guy does not know. He has no idea. He's been killing these women all over London. And the psychiatrist is like, tells the detective, don't prove it to him. You'll destroy him. And the detective just keeps pushing and pushing until the nice guy realizes that he is through, you know, just, and they come together and it's, and that's the end of the movie. It's, you know, the guy like shatters his brain and there's just like scary music, right? So it has something, there's something to do with that, you know? I tell people that, everybody wants to be seen, really seen, and everybody's terrified of being seen. Wholeness. Why don't you ask something about?
I'm curious about wholeness and, that's a good. Just in a sense, like, how can we attend, abide in the natural state? But let's go to wholeness as well. Like, because I think we're kind of, it's like almost like a pointing out instruction that we're doing. Yeah.
So the notion of wholeness, I think, is really important. And maybe I'll even, I wasn't planning on doing this, but, weave in AI and into it. And the wholeness has become a very dangerous idea, because people imagine wholeness to be some kind of omega point, like that eventually, you know, with AI and technology, the human brain will enter the newest sphere and we'll all be at the, you know, have one mind. And finally, that's what they envision when they think of wholeness. And this to me is a very dystopian idea. It's very rampant in postmodernism. Post-war humanism was an attempt for like, get like everybody under one culture. I just read a couple of, somewhat processed theologies where, it sounds like she's saying some really beautiful things, but she has this concept of in the future, people will evolve, the same way matter evolves to life and life to mind, you know, mind will evolve to this post-human or something. And the mental models here are that the many become one. That sounds nice. Oh, and the many become one, one agglutinized mass. So that's not the kind of wholeness that I think is actually possible. I think it's a problem with our metaphysics. It's a problem with our, postmodern culture. Every time people think of wholeness in one mind, of course, they think that one mind is more like themselves, you know, like, oh, we're all going to be this one beautiful family. And guess what? It'll be more like me, you know, so there's all tainted with all these mistakes. People, and I'm writing about this now, and it's a process theology, but the wholeness that is actually the case is more like this. Let me ask you, is the first amoeba still alive? Kind of yes and kind of no, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what you have is you have division, but let's say, that, but after 110 billionth division, the amoebas don't get to be 110th billionth the size, right? So you have division without diminution. And that's what wholeness is. You have differentiation without diminution. The wholeness comes from the deeper universals, common genealogy. And so to create a theology or to a futuristic plan about becoming whole is a tragedy of faith. You've lost faith that the wholeness is already there. And hence it destroys all connection. That attitude fragments society because it's a distorted and false belief. And it comes from a perversion of what reality is to start with.
Yeah.
So it's just bad faith, and its consequences. So this whole movement, techno movement, neoliberal capitalism also envisions the same kind of whole economy. This is not healthy wholeness. Now, some people think it's going to be healthy wholeness because it'll just be centralized by AI and no elite, powerful elite are going to sit at the top. And that's even more scary. I read an article that said, that a powerful enough AI could create an infinitely stable autocracy, right? Because it could respond to every single person all the time to keep them balanced and homeostatic level. So that, you know, whereas all autocracies, eventually the people get pissed off. And so this is the definition of death when there's no, you know, life lives at the edge of novelty and chaos. So the perfectly homeostatic organism is dead. So this notion of wholeness is crucial to understand from the correct, let's say, metaphysical proposition. And I just use this story. I just ask people, you know, is the original amoeba still around?
And is it a phenomenological experience of wholeness too that we can access?
I think it's because deep down inside, we understand there's wholeness. A wholeness discloses it to ourselves, but then all we see is difference. And so we think we have to do something about it. It's the same phenomenology of the self. The self only experiences multiplicity. And so it will try to create these structures like I am the author of the scripts that I, the many scripts that I talk to, or later in the development of the identity, we have the autobiographical self. I know that I've done all these crazy many multiple things over my lifetime, but I can thread it together with a story. So now it feels whole again. And so the identity project is the self trying to make explicit its own wholeness until all of a sudden it realized, I'm whole because I'm the one that's running around trying to make things. You know, the wholeness doesn't need to be made. It is ever present. It is, the natural state of the self. And so you kind of got snookered. Because you can't turn around and look at your own wholeness. So you've kind of had a project where you try to make that happen through different, stages of identity development. So it's the same with, it's at the root of a distorted view of complexity too. The body knows how to maintain its wholeness, and complex systems are dynamically whole, you know, and so yeah. So there's a lot more to be said. I was just going to go down a rabbit hole, but it's just filled with kind of jargon. So, but it's important to understand these two movements in society. There's a whole big movement to make, humans in a gluttonized mass. And, yeah, there's all kinds of metaphysical mistakes in some of these philosophies. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My experience of wholeness has been as well when that it has to include the body and has to include like a move into the body and a kind of an attitude of embracing what's here. And that, in a sense, like, can only be done once I've moved beyond the purely rational ledger-based splitting mind, you know, that's like, because that's the mind that's kind of distracting me from that wholeness that I am. So once I shift out of that, then, and recognize how I'm kind of interfering with my wholeness, and then everything settles, and then it's like that sense of wholeness reveals itself, and it's like, oh, it was already here. And there's a sense of nothing missing in that moment. And I think part of that is because I'm out of that mind that's like, you know, looking out and abstracting.
Yeah. Well, that's what the word abstract means. You abstract from the wholeness variables, isolated variables. And that's useful. But then you think, once you're manipulating the abstraction, you think everything else has come along with it. And everything else doesn't come along with it. So then when you make decisions based upon that thinking, what doesn't come along with it is 99% of the pie. You know, in my work, in this metaphysics I'm writing, we have this term, I have this term substraction, which is like an abstraction, but it's also like you subtract stuff out of reality. A simple example, because it gets quite conceptually dense. So when I say, okay, pizza is made of dough, right? Well, I can say, you know, the human body is made of cells, and cells are made of molecules, and molecules are made of matter. So I have this view of stratified reality that has these discrete levels, right? So subtraction means you've taken away 99.9% of what you're talking about. So you get these clear and distinct discontinuities. So if I say pizza is made out of dough, that's different than I say, what is dough made out of? Dough is made out of wheat. What is wheat made out of? And you go on and on and on. But if I say pizza is made with dough, and with my hands, and with the hearth, and with wheat, and wheat is made with the soil, and the soil is made with agriculture, and agriculture is made with the evolution of the human condition, and the evolution of, you see, you realize that the with, it includes much more than the of, right? So when you get to saying cells are made of matter, well, what is matter made of? Matter is made with the experimental method and experimental setup and the theory in which matter as an abstraction comes through. And that theory is made with people and the scientific enterprise and with bureaucracies that fund the science. So inside of matter, causally, is all of human enterprise and their evolution. So when we abstract, we subtract 99.9% of the reality. And I like to say, this is why scientists tell you, physicists tell you, that of all the forces, the energy and matter that we study, it's only like 7%. The other 93% is in dark matter and dark energy. And I say, huh. Not surprising, because we study things with the lens of what are they made of. And so, boom, we discover that they're made with the 97% that we know nothing about. Now you get back to the amoeba. I can't go and point to the first amoeba. And I can't go and point this pen and show you that it's made with human evolution. But it is made with human evolution, which is made with the history of the planet. Everything is made with everything else. So in process philosophy, that's called things are internal. Those are the internal relations of things, and they get subtracted when you look at things retrospectively, which is, you know, to study anything, you have to put it under a microscope, keep it static for a while. I mean, you can't, because if you're actually not doing that, then everything is just passing, right? You can't study it. So these things are not, once you get it, you understand these principles that I'm talking about, there, it's a lot, and now I'm doing a big download, but they're not so mysterious that we can't work on them as a culture. We can't work on them as a practice, that we can't envision schools that orient us toward our own conditioned way of living in the world and improve on that.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful, like with and of is so, because it's quite profound, isn't it? I mean, it's very profound because it, in a way, it encapsulates the whole conversation, you know, that maybe one thing we're moving to is a, or this new spirit is a with spirit, you know, it's like, where we see we're made with, we are with things, we're in relationship, we're being touched and touching and so, and disclosing. And
it's the with that makes things seem discontinuous, because you can't point to the with. I can point to the dough and maybe the wheat, the flour, right? But I can't point to the agricultural revolution. So it makes things seem discontinuous, and they are in that sense discontinuous. That's why they appear to us that way. In the same way you can't point to the first amoeba. You just can't. They're not salvageable, but they're not gone. I mean, it's a really, they're a powerful mind shift. And, I'm very excited to teach and journey with other people in this direction. We've been working really hard at the pop-up school to create some fundamental insights so that we don't keep making mistakes. But this is the first year that I'm introducing kind of the novelty of what this new spirit is.
Maybe, you know, we're going to moving to the end of our time now. You could just direct people to the pop-up school. And I recommend people check out your Substack as well. Maybe there's an invitation other than check out the pop-up school, like just an invitation. This whole conversation is an invitation in a way, but yeah, something explicit now that people may follow or not.
Yeah. So the pop-up school is the Substack. So it's BonitaRoy.substack.com or something, or you could just put in my name in the pop-up school. There is a new series at the pop-up school where, some of these things that I've been talking about, the metaphysics, is being written for free subscribers. And it's accompanied by a video presentation of the material, and that would be for paid subscribers. So that's a really sweet deal, because the pop-up school Substack, it's, you know, it's not a newsletter. It's $40 a month. You get all the course content for free. But if you're interested in the video pre-recorded course on this one, topology of process relations or this new metaphysics, you can just sign up for 1 month, and for $40, you get the whole short course. So, there's a lot of good opportunity there, to read and explore, lots of this content. All the content, that I've talked about will be available in one form or another. So then the lyric culture, This is a 7-month online course. We've got a great group of people. This is more like a participatory course where through dialogue, we are envisioning more ways to be as lyrical as possible. And a lot of these phrases that I use today that help us understand what we're talking about come through being with that group all last year. So as we talk, we, you know, like the amoeba, which the amoeba metaphor, which is a great way to introduce this, is really cut through the complexity of what if I talk to you about the topology of process relations. We were kind of trying to get talking about this at the end of last year, and then the idea of the amoeba metaphor came through that. So a lot of the actual emergence of these ideas is through that that group that is, I call them the enrolled people. They enroll for the whole year. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on there. We do have a newbies hour for the next 2 months. So if you want to join, you can join at 11 a.m. on every other Saturday, because the core group has been together so long, the newbies, it's like, it's hard for them to get in. But we do have a large cohort of newbies that will be integrated. So it's a good time to get in if you want to start to get in.
Nice. Nice. And that's 11 a.m. Eastern time.
Yes. But it's all on the you know, Substack, all that information.
Cool. Hey, Benita, just thanks so much for your time and for kind of being willing to answer all my questions. I feel like I'm just peppering questions at you sometimes, but yeah, I really appreciate. And I, you know, I just want to name, like, I can feel how this conversation has kind of transformed me in my perception in this moment. It's really nice. So
yeah, it's always wonderful to talk with you. And, you know, I was just thinking, like, wow, we did a lot at the pop-up school since last time I talked, you know? I mean, these ideas are always on the horizon, but being able to disclose this reality without, you know, I love doing metaphysics, and if you like metaphysics, I'm writing the metaphysics. That's more like naming. But it just shows what is possible. People come together and work with each other.
Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well. And I'll see you again next time.